Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name's Heather Neal, and I'm with James Hayes at the National Theatre, 2 days after the fabulous 50th anniversary gala was staged here, but only one day after I watched James in Leola on the Littleton stage. It's fitting that he's been performing here over the anniversary because he was in the original Old Vic Company and has knocked up more NT productions than anyone else alive. So, this is a time for revelling in nostalgia, but it's also still a time for enjoying the present. Because James is very active still, so thank you very much for fitting in a chat with Theatre Voice. Before you take the stage again for
tonight,
to play
yes.
Simone, the old landowner who...
nasty minute goods, isn't
he? He is nasty. Not in character at all.
Ha ha, you say. Yes.
Anyway, let's go back to those days at the Old Vic, because you were you there at the very beginning?
I went to drama school, literally about 400 yards, the old Guildhall, just across the river here, in 63, and I had no grant, because I'd come from Ireland. I knew nothing about theatre, and I got into the Guildhall. It was the only school I tried for. But I was having a very bad time, and Lindsay Anderson, I was sent to meet Lindsay Anderson. He directed a play called... oh my God, brain dying. It'll come to him in a minute. Yeah. Anyway, I went to meet him, and he asked me to go and just be a soldier in it. The National Theatre was sending out its first tour, and I had to go up on stage, and it was called Andorra by Max Frisch.
Of course, yes.
And so I was a soldier on stage. And when I remember during when they were shoving a few of us in to do that, and damn glad I was to get it, I say I needed the money, but... I remember doing this little tech, and this man suddenly walked down the aisle. It was around lunchtime in a three-piece suit and horn-rimmed glasses. And I thought, my God, people are walking off the street. This is terrible. And, of course, all the people around me suddenly got a bit kind of stiff and whatever. And it was Sir Lawrence, first time I'd ever seen him, you know. So I did that for a few weeks, and that was handy. And then I went and finished my drama school and went off into rep. And then I got an interview. I had three interviews to join the company in 1967, 1968, I think. First interview was with Robert Stevens, and then Frank Dunlop, and then, of course, pre-answer machines, pre-mobile phones, I got a phone call on Sunday night from Don McKechnie, who'd given me my first job in the provinces, who was now working with Sir Lawrence, and he said to me, "Where have you been all weekend?" I said, "Well, I've been out and about, you know." I said, "What do you want? Why?" He said, "You know, it's just you're seeing Sir Lawrence at 10 o'clock in the morning. For an audition." Now, one of my pieces was Richard III, and I wasn't going to do that, although I think Michael Gambon did it,
I think
He did it. And I dug out some Cassius. I'd been playing Cassius in rep at Stoke-on-Trent a few weeks before and did that. And I got up early in the morning and went to a park and did voice work, and well, that made it right. Luckily, there's not many people about. And then I went to the Vic and was shown up to the rehearsal room. Donald said, "Come in early, you can have the room on your own for a while." So I thought, oh, yes, lovely. And then the door opened and a kind of what seemed like a phalanx of people came in, but there was probably about five. And there was Sir Lawrence walking towards me, and I thought, well, I was so frightened, you know. And he was really nice and took me for a walk around the room and asked me what I was going to do, and I said I was doing an American play, and he talked about accents, and I began to relax. I thought, this is very nice. And then he said, "Off you go, dear boy." And then he went and sat down. And I did a play called... Zoo Story, an excerpt from Zoo Albie. Story, Edward Albee, and there's a great story in it, the story of Jerry and the dog, and it's a long, long story. These two men sit in a park bench, and Jerry's a strange man, and he tells a story about the dog in the apartment building that he lives in. And I was so green, Heather. Sir Lawrence stopped me after a while. I thought, Jesus, he hates me, he hates me. And he said, "What's your next piece?" And I said, "Cassius," and I did that, and that was fine. And what was lovely was he could be so charming. You know, he walked up the room afterwards and was very nice to me and shook my hand and said, "I look forward to working with you, dear boy." So I knew I had the job on the spot. But when I got home, I looked up at the Zoo Story. I thought, he stopped me, Gene. And I reckon he let me go on for about 4 or 5 minutes. I had an 8-minute speech. It was a very long speech, and I'd learned the whole thing. He'd no time for all that. So then I joined the company, took over in the All Male As You Like It, Derek Jacobi, Ronnie Pickup, Jeremy Brett. Wonderful, wonderful production. Edward II. And then, of course, I had to sign, I think, for a year. players cast, but I came in and played Curio. Not Curio. Is it in 12th? No, in that As You Like It. I had to sing all the songs. They're all a bit modern and bossa nova-ish with a guitar. That was good fun. So that was my first week or two here.
Yes.
And then at the end of the year, I was off. I begin to have family. I stayed for years.
Who are we talking about? Feste or
Curio?
Touchstone?
No, Derek Jacobi did Touchstone.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And he played that like... He was like Frankie Howard.
Yeah.
If you said so. And Charlie Kay, who was in the thing on Saturday night.
Yeah.
Charlie was Celia, and he was like Marjorie Proops, I remember. He had these glasses.
Did he take over from Ian Holm? Anyway.
I don't really know.
Yeah.
Jeremy Brett as God, I'm getting confused now, these characters.
Orlando.
And Ronnie as Rosalind. And he was absolutely wonderful. Yeah. And a rather plastic set. So it was all very modern and almost space-agey. And this wonderful music by Mark Wilkinson.
Oh, yeah.
I still can't remember the name of the bloody character I played.
Anyway, well,
but it was great fun. It was great fun. And then I just went on and on and did so many plays here. So many.
You've mentioned on a previous occasion in a platform here, Dance of Death.
Oh, yes. Well, that I did that.
But that was earlier.
That was around that time, I think. Hmm. I can't remember the year of Dance of Death. And
that was Olivier
Sir Lawrence, yes.
And Geraldine McKeown.
I was in the company, as I say, doing very little. And I was shoved in for a few weeks, I think, take over from someone like Anthony Hopkins, who was a sentry or something. And I had to go and stand outside a door and walk up and down behind it. And Sir Lawrence would come out and have a few words with me, and off he'd go. And I was thrilled, you know. And I think I mentioned the platform. He had, because it's set on some island, I think, in Sweden, he had some kind of Morse code machine.
That's right, yeah.
He sent messages, telegraph machine. Mm. And he insisted, of course, on doing it properly. So some poor stage manager had to be in the wings with the corresponding machine, sending him messages. They had to learn all that, you know. And I well remember how funny he was at the beginning, and he and Geraldine, because she was a famous comedy lady, really, wasn't she? And when it started, they were so funny. And I thought, oh, Strindberg's all right. I hear this is a long play, but this will be fine. And then after a little while, all that marital discord.
Yeah.
And then you think, oh, my God. But they were extraordinary. I think, I personally think that was the best performance of his I've seen on a stage, and the least characterized, because he just had a little stubbly moustache and that uniform, and I thought he was astonishing in that. Astonishing. And she was
and
wonderful as well.
He did that amazing
well.
Dance.
That
the,
dance.
The
and
dance
then he, didn't he get carried off in a wheelchair at the end with his foot dragging the carpet?
Right. Mm.
And Geraldine was wonderful. Wonderful, the hissy voice of hers. And she was also, of course, I still think she gave the funniest female performance I've ever seen in my life in Flea Maria, which I wasn't in, but God, that made me laugh a lot, the pace of that. And on I went, and then got... John Dexter took a bit of a shine to me, which was very nice, because John, of course, could be... He's dead now, alas, but he was good to me, and he was an astonishing director, but you wouldn't get away with that kind of director anymore. Because he would sack people, all that. And I told that story on the platform about when Alec McCallum and I were doing Misanthrope, and we had the scene together, which was quite funny, and Dinah Rigg was in it. It was all looking like it was going to be a big smash hit, which it was. And Alec and I did this scene, and we were quite pleased with it, and we'd done it a few times. So we were corpsing a bit during the rehearsal, and we hadn't realised John was in... bit of a bad mood that day, and we got to the end of the scene and we looked at him, you know, for a little note perhaps, and he just didn't speak for a minute, and then he said to us, "I suppose you think that scene's funny," he said, "that fucking scene is about as funny as a child's open grave. Do it again." And we did it, and we didn't laugh from then on.
Well, it's a bit difficult to make it funny.
Indeed. But a good-natured man I did with him, Olive Goldsmith's only other full-length play, which was great. It wasn't very successful, but was great fun to do. And then years later, when I came to this building here on the South Bank, John had me in to do Galileo with Michael Gambon.
Michael Gambon playing
Galileo. He was astonishing. It was... unbelievably brilliant, and to see him develop that through the rehearsal period. And something happened that night after the press night, because we just knew he'd just given this extraordinary performance. And when we were in the dressing rooms after, which was like they're like that concrete, but like an Italian tenement, all the floors of the dressing rooms all look out into a quadrangle. Yeah. And
so you can see across.
See everyone's rooms. And we were all at the window and messing about. And then Michael came to the window and he was shouting, "Keep the noise down," all messing about. And suddenly, I certainly didn't start it, but someone did. And we all just banged the windows. Mm. Lots of windows, 30, 40 windows, banging to show our appreciation of him. And that has now become a custom here. It's done in a different way now. On the opening press night of any show, whoever's doing a show in the building, they go to the window for the new show coming in and bang the windows. But he was astonishing in that. And then not long after, I did View from the Bridge with him, which he was equally as good.
And what were you in
Eddie
that?
Carbone. I was his lawyer and the narrator. Yes. Alfieri, he's called. Yes. Quite a nice part. And Alan Ayckbourn, of all people, directed it. And I remember a lot of people getting very sniffy about Alan, thinking,
"Oh, it was brilliant.
He shouldn't be allowed to do that kind of thing."
Mm. But do you know how many productions you've been in?
Nicholas Heitner told me about 37,
oh,
he said.
Goodness.
Yes. Someone told me, he told me only Michael Bryant has done more than me.
Yes. Well, he did 55, apparently.
Oh, my God. Well, I doubt I got near that. But
but you are still alive, though.
I'm still alive.
So you've still got time to do some.
Oh, God, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, Leolar's great fun. And I was thrilled to do the NT50. I mean, to have been here
yes,
the first
I
year
just
and then.
I heard that you actually did a performance of Leolar in the Littleton that evening.
On Saturday night.
On
yes.
Saturday night. And then nipped up to be a patient in
That's right.
the National Health
well,
scene.
Because the broadcast stroke gala whole evening started at 9, and Leolar's one. There's no interval. We were down at 9:08 or something. Well,
yes,
I skipped.
It's only an hour and 40, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I skipped the dress rehearsal.
Right.
And I'd already started unbuttoning bits of my shirt under my waistcoat and all that. And so I ran off and didn't do the curtain call and ran to my dressing room. There were four people there pulling clothes off me and getting off this Italian makeup and have this moustache grown, all which was blacked up, and I had to make all that white, and then it had to make me look ill to die in a bed, and put a radio mic, all that for the broadcast on. And then I ran up and there was Maggie Smith in the slip, and I thought, Jesus, oh my God, if she's off, I've missed it. And she said, "No, I haven't been on yet," she said. So I knew I was right, and I had about a couple of minutes to spare, and then went on. It was, well, I only did a scrap in it. But the end was lovely, because I was in the final curtain call with Derek and Gambon and Maggie Smith, and there was eight of us who'd been in that first
in the
decade.
Original,
yes.
In
yes.
the original company.
Yes.
Were you in Othello?
I've done
the Olivier's Othello.
I watched the dress rehearsal, because that's when I was at drama school, and they let me, when I was doing Andorra, they let me watch the dress. There was about 30 of us in the stalls, so that was astonishing to be there.
Yeah. And I watched it loads and loads of times, because I was selling programmes.
Well, people are sniffy now about the movie.
Well, yes,
and
you
all
couldn't
that.
Have anyone blacking up.
Indeed,
like that, no.
But. For its time, and when he walked on at the beginning in that white robe with the bare feet and carrying that long-stemmed rose, you know. Do you know that story about Maggie Smith? She was in it playing Desdemona. Do you know that story when she, he said to Maggie, "Darling, you've got to work on your vowels." She had a drawling voice.
Yes.
Anyway, he said, "Work on your voice." And, of course, it took him something like 2 hours to get made up every night. And after a few performances, whatever, she came into his dressing room one night before the show. He was all being browned up and all that. And she stood in front of him and she said, "How now, brown car?" But that was astonishing. I love watching him. I thought, recruiting officer, he was amazing in. He was amazing in the recruiting. So funny.
Yes. And
so
that
was groundbreaking. She
Smith.
Was. Well, everyone. Yes, Robert Stevens. But, she was amazing. Yes, Lynn Redgrave. Mm. And the fact that it blew away all the cobwebs from that that old way of doing restoration comedy with lots of lace and people bowing and yes, milady. And, you know, people come on with mud in their boots if they've ridden horses. They looked as if they were wearing clothes as opposed to costumes, you know.
Yes.
A wonderful, wonderful production.
Different. Phew. You have hardly taken breath, and you've hardly taken breath this week, have you?
I haven't. But I love it. I love it. That's I just love it.
We do.
I love work.
It doesn't seem to be wearing you out at all, anyway.
Not at all.
When you started at the Old Vic, you joined a company then, didn't you?
You joined a company,
and,
yes.
And so you
£17 a week and 30 bob a performance.
And you so you signed a contract for a year?
A year, yes.
And you and the facilities weren't exactly brilliant there, were they?
Oh, well, I mean, the Vic was... No.
It was meant to be temporary home,
it was,
of course,
it was.
And it went on being a temporary
and
home.
And the old annex, which is now the studio.
For 13 or 14 years.
Yeah. That annex was where all the costumes were and the scenes were painted and the wig department were. And the stage door was the other side on the Waterloo Road.
That's right.
And we used to go in the pub next door. Mm. And we had the rehearsal rooms up in Aquinas Street, a little street, on an old bomb site. They'd put these Nissen huts together. And four of them, I think, were turned into a rehearsal room. There was a yard outside, and you could drive there. Even when we took plays up the West End in those days, if you had a matinee, you could drive in the West End and park for nothing after half one. But at Aquinas Street, these huts, and there were pillars. You had to rehearse around the pillars, and they leaked. It was just plywood or hardboard or whatever. Mm. Astonishing. Kicking ball out in the yard if we weren't on. Keep the noise down. Someone come out and say, keep the noise down. So Lawrence can't hear himself rehearse. All that went on.
He could be quite fierce, couldn't
he? Oh, yeah, he could be. Yes, yeah. There were times when he would be very, very pally and lovely to you. How are you, James, you know? And other times when you'd pass him in a corridor and his mind would be full of something in those eyes, you know?
Yeah.
But we had a canteen there with these two. I told that story about Rose and Nell.
Oh, yes.
Because it was a tatty old building, but they
this
ran
was at the Aquinas Street.
At Aquinas Street,
because there was one in the old Vic.
There was one
well.
In the in the in
that's
the
right, where,
in
where
I don't know what's down there now. It was in the basement.
No, I don't know.
The awful worry then was again was being left with Sir Lawrence at a table if you sat down and all the others left and you were there.
Yes, but we all used to eat there as well.
Indeed, it was wonderful. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, what we've got here, I remember Douglas Cornelison, a company manager, bringing me here to this site where we are now in about, must have been 1972 or 3 or something. And this was an old bomb site, I think. Mm. There was Daily Mail vans parked here in the mud.
It was not salubrious in this area.
No,
at
the whole,
all.
Everything east of here was industrial.
Yeah.
And he said, this is where the National Theatre is going to be. This is where it's going to be. But those early days, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I interrupted you. We're going to tell your story about Rose and the canteen.
Well, this little canteen with a low ceiling and these little wooden huts, and we were thrilled to be working at the National Theatre. The people we were working with was astonishing. And, of course, the RSC had only been going a short time as well, so these major companies were still relatively new. And in the canteen, Rose ran it, and she was very London, very buxom, very red-cheeked and glasses and hair, rather fuzzy, and she was the life and soul. Hello, darling, what can I get you? Oh, yes, yeah, fish and chips, all that. And then there was a character behind her called Nell, and Nell was a rather small, pinched creature. She was a lovely woman, but she was small and rather private, and she didn't like to have eye contact with you. So Rose would be there in the background, moving slowly with plates. She didn't do anything serving us. And Rose would be at the front, oh, darling, yes. And Maggie Smith was in the queue one day, and someone said to her, isn't Rose marvellous? Isn't Rose marvellous? And she said, yes, but Nell's the better part. It was a very good acting note, I thought. Very good acting note. But when you compare the facilities here now, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
But we were just thrilled, and I worked so hard. You'd go to Aquinas Street at 10 in the morning, because you would do seven shows a week at the same time, because you were always rehearsing a new one. It just went on and on.
Yeah. The stage at the Old Vic was very steeply raked in those days, wasn't it?
Well, I think, yes, and also they built out a bit. I think they've taken that away.
Mm.
I remember doing a play with Paul Scofield, the Captain of Copernic, which I've done here since recently, and he ran on. We had these entrances downstage with a doorway, and Paul was quite tall, and he hit his head going on, and blood. He continued the scene with this blood on his face. The audience go, oh, my God. And he came off, had it bandaged, and on we went again, you know?
Well, you've mentioned a few people in the company. Maggie Smith was one, and Anthony Hopkins, and Michael Gambon. And people like Michael Gambon and Tony Hopkins were holding spears at the time, weren't they?
Oh, very much so, yes, yeah. Yes. I mean, Michael, of course, he's such a great storyteller. I'm not sure I believe all of them.
No, but he's quite good at spinning a lie.
He was doing a play at the Vic, and he wasn't in the end. He didn't appear for the last 20 minutes, so one night he thought, I'm going to skip the curtain call. So he got out of costume.
And he was wearing an armour or something as well, wasn't he?
God knows. Anyway, I heard, he said, he got out the gear, ran out the stage door, was running up the Waterloo Road, and he looked across the road, and there was John Dexter coming down towards him, who directed the play. So John was going in to see the last few minutes of the play, and Michael just panicked and ran round some streets and got back into the building, had to get into costume, and already John Dexter was threatening. He said, I think I've seen Michael Gambon go off the Waterloo Road. Off came the curtain call, and there's Michael, all sweat, taking the bow. I also remember there that because repertoire, which I knew nothing about in repertoire, there were actors who'd miss performances. There'd be actors at the cinema one day and think, gee! And they realised they had a matinee in 20 minutes or something. Or an actor arriving one day early in the evening, and he saw a lot of us at the stage door, and you could see a dawn on his face over about four paces that he'd missed the matinee, you know?
Oh, my goodness.
It was.
I hope it wasn't a lead role.
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. Yes, Anthony Hopkins. I thought he'd never work again because he walked out of so many shows. He got out of Macbeth with a doctor's certificate. He was going to do The Misanthrope, which I mentioned earlier, he'd never read the play properly.
That was Dinah Rigg, wasn't it?
Dinah Rigg. Yeah. And then he turned up for the reading or something and realised it wasn't as big a part as he thought. And he said, I'm not doing it. And John Dex said, Sevier, you're right. I'm getting rid of you.
Oh,
he said,
gosh.
Teach her to read the play. So he got out of that. And there was three projects. And of course, he was a very good actor and wonderful. But I thought, he'll never work again, this guy. You know? Never. Yeah. I thought he'll never work. Look at him. God.
He's done all right.
Yes.
But still,
yes.
A lot of people have mentioned Pravda during this celebration, remembering people.
Yes. Rafe did a lovely bit the other night in the celebration. I wasn't in that, but I saw it, and Tony was astonishing in that. Mm. I remember coming backstage to see him afterwards, and he was coming down the stairs with Meryl Streep, but she was dressed rather. I believe she was there on Saturday night.
Oh, really?
Someone said. But he was with this woman, rather not flashily dressed, and I said, Tony, terrific tonight, terrific performance. And I looked at, and I saw, oh my God, it's Meryl Streep. And like an idiot, I said, oh, and you're terrific too. I said, terrible, terrible. You know that thing about big stars when you meet them. Golden days, golden days.
But what was it like moving in here, though? Because what was
the first
thing
show
did
I
here?
Did was Galileo and John Dexter. And John, of course, Love was a great stage of a play. So we had the luxury of having the set, or most of the set, in the rehearsal room. The rehearsal room would be brought in. These huge doors would open, and it wouldn't arrive in the first week or so, but after a few weeks. And also, John then had a platform built along one wall, about 6 foot high, made out of just cheap wood. And he would go up a ladder to this, and direct us, because he could see. He was brilliant at the visual stuff, you know? And he'd be up there. I mean, you unheard of nowadays. Unheard of. But there was some great. I mean, there was a famous scene. I don't know if it's written in Brecht's text, where the dressing of the Pope, Basil Henson playing the Pope, and Stephen Moore turned up as an inquisitor, and they had a two-hand scene. But throughout the scene, Basil had to be dressed as the Pope from virtually a night shirt.
Yeah.
And six monks did this throughout the scene, very slowly, beautifully rehearsed, and God help one of them if he was a foot behind on a move or on putting something on Basil or putting the three-tiered crown on. And they spent hours working on that, sweaty poor buggers worrying they'd get the sack at any minute. And yet you look at the scene, and all you noticed after a while, you say, oh, the Pope's being dressed. And then you just listen to the two-handed scene, because the focus, with all this going on, was still on the two actors. John was a great stage room player.
Yeah.
I remember seeing his obituary in The Guardian, and I was flashing through the paper, and there was a half-page picture of him, and a big obituary. And I kept going over the page. I couldn't believe it. I had to go back. You couldn't believe that a man with such a strong life force could have died, you know?
Mm.
Did you ever see The Front Page of The National?
I did, yeah.
Michael Blakemore. God, that was a good show. We loved doing that.
We loved doing that. Yeah.
And also, now, there was an interesting thing, because we were all in the company, he cast Alan McNaughton as the editor.
Yes.
Now, if... You'd never have imagined Alan could play that part, but because he was in the company, he was cast, and he gave an absolutely wonderful performance. Someone else might have cast someone different, or a name, or physically, but I thought that was just an astonishing... And Dennis Quilley, and of course Michael loved the movie, so we had a lot of effects of bullets in the wall and windows breaking. And we played all these journalists, and we'd never... I mean, I think it's the best American comedy ever written, and we spent a long time at fast pace, and it was all through the the Nixon Watergate. We were always discussing that every morning in rehearsal with Michael.
Is that your favorite one to be in?
It was my favorite one at the Vic. Yes, it was. It was just wonderful. But I've done so many, I can't remember them all now.
I am going to mention Romans in Britain, because huge furore about that, wasn't there?
A huge furore, and yet...
This is Michael Bogdanoff's production of Howard Brenton's play.
Indeed, and it all revolved around that male rape scene, which was staged very simply and in no way crudely.
It was really about colonialism, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah. Funny enough, I didn't think... I shouldn't say this, really. At the same time, or soon after I saw that play, which went over the whole... of British history, didn't it? From the Romans right up to Northern Ireland, because I played an IRA man at the end of that, where Stephen Moore, I had to kill him. Harold Pinter told me I was quite menacing in it. That made me feel good. But a few weeks, maybe later, months, I saw Translations set in a little tiny village in Northern Ireland, and it's about the same thing in a way. It's a much better play.
It's a wonderful
play. I shouldn't say that. I like Howard very much.
Oh, but
better.
I think Translations is many people's favourite play, really.
I'm debating whether to do it right now. I've been asked to do it.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, you must do.
I don't know. It's a long tour up in Sheffield and that. But
Working with Daniel?
No, some young director, James Grieve, I think. Right. I don't know him, but I met him.
But starting at Sheffield?
Starting at Sheffield and touring, and then into the Rose in Kingston weeks later. But it's a lot of winter touring. I'm getting a bit old. I don't know. I'm going to read it and have a think. I am 72.
Life,
a lot of life.
Yeah.
And I'm off to New York on Thursday. So
the minute you come off stage here, you go home,
go to bed, and pack, and leave the next morning, and do a show that night.
No, not,
yeah.
Oh no,
I'm doing the press night that night. They're all out there already. They've all gone out ahead of me. Someone's reading in for me.
I thought at least you'd have a day to get over.
No, it'll be all right. Be all right. I get there American time by about 1 o'clock. So I mean, we only read it. It's only an hour and a quarter. And we've done it before.
Yes, this is Beckett.
Yes, all that fall. Yeah. And, I mean, Michael Gambon and Eileen Atkins have obviously the main roles. The rest of us are playing all the peripheral characters. I'm playing Mr. Barrel, the station master. It's a wonderful play.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful play. This old lady going to pick up her husband at the station. And it's funny. It's not like Beckett at all.
Yeah.
I mean, there's bits of it's wonderful.
So,
Trevor had a lot of trouble getting the rights because the
Beckett estate.
They're like Ayatollahs, the fundamentalists. They won't give any. Trevor tried for decades; they wouldn't have it. And then he came up with the idea of doing it as if it's set in a radio studio, which is how we do it, in a black box with microphones hanging.
Right.
And we have the merest hint of costume. And with the scripts in our hands, and we move about and do things. And of course, there's Beckett wrote in so many sound effects, you know, from chickens to trains to motor cars.
Do you see people doing the sound effects?
No, you don't see that, but they are going on virtually all the time. Some technical person doing that kind of job, I don't know how they do it. There's probably 100 cues, you know, in an hour. It's really, really wonderful.
Well, you're going straight into a press night. What do you think about press nights generally?
Hate them.
I don't think there's an actor who doesn't hate them.
I've got a bit better at them. That little bit in the NT50 celebration the other night when Francis Delatour spoke that speech at the end and about fear, actors' fear and all that, is so... If you're backstage with a bunch of actors in press night, if you're not in the press night, you are very... if you're in the building, you'll feel very, very good because you're seeing a lot of nerves. And that's why we go into that flim-flam with good luck and press night cards and all that. And it's fear, really. I don't know why. Once or twice it's been all right, but most times your mouth is dry as you walk on, you know.
It's difficult to see how to solve this, really, because you have to have the one night, don't you?
You have to have it, and it's necessary, and it, of course, doing a good show that night is important, you know.
Yeah.
And of course, you have to have nerves as an actor. You can't walk on. It's impossible to act without adrenaline and the buzz of it.
But it's always good, as somebody sometimes reviews, to see something on the press night and then for some reason see it another time.
Do you notice a difference?
Oh, yeah.
A big difference.
Quite often
yes.
Well, of course, sometimes it's just that it's sort of bedded in.
Yes, and people are
feeling familiar and relaxed about it.
I've been in shows, some great press nights, but other nights, you know, we could have done that better, you know.
Yes.
It's a strange thing.
Yes, and that's the one that gets written about, and that's as if it is always the same.
Indeed. And, of course, it doesn't. It should develop a lot, but as it goes on, plays do. I mean, in a comedy, you get a few previews, but I love doing comedy, and you need 10, 20 performances to suddenly... You not only play with the other actors, but after a while, you're playing with the audience because you're timing... your instinct and how they react to it. And I mean, there's a computer, acting computer in the brain that, oh, that was a nice laugh. I didn't know that was there. Or there are laughs when you think, I think this is going to be very good. Because everyone's laughed in rehearsal, you know. And you do it, and it's great. And then there's another bit, and you think, they love this. And there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing. And you're devastated.
Yeah.
And they're actors' laughs, not audience laughs.
Oh, dear. But audiences are unpredictable anyway, aren't
always,
they?
Always, you know. And we talk about them in terrible ways, you know.
Yes.
What are they like tonight? Bloody awful.
Yes.
As if they've paid good money to come and not give us a good reaction.
And they've
to
all
our...
got together beforehand, and but audiences are as one, though, aren't they? You think of them as
them.
An entity,
yes,
not
them.
As a whole lot
yes.
of people.
And it is an extraordinary thing. It is a wonder. I'm almost amazed in this great city, where possibly the best theatre in the world goes on and has gone on for decades, that theatres, so many of them, from little... I've played them all, the Fringe, the West End, these huge houses. You expect good audiences here, but people turn up every night to see a show. There's something wonderful and moving about it, about... people gathering in a space. It goes back to probably cavemen telling stories or whatever. And there's nothing like it. There is nothing like it at all. Doing television and all that, a film, nothing like it. The buzz of that sound as you're coming on.
I suppose we ought to finish in a minute. I suppose I ought not to let the Romans and Britain story go completely.
All right.
Because there was a court case. Did you have anything... You didn't have to...
No, I didn't. I wasn't in that scene, though I did play an ancient Roman. I looked like Rod Stewart with some kind of terrible red spiky wig. But I think Greg Hicks and Peter Spool were interviewed.
Greg was the one being raped.
Being raped, yes. And I think maybe John Mortimer or something put them through a questioning.
I think so.
And I think there was a... Bogdanov went to court. I think it got quite far.
But yes, because I was... around here at the time doing the education notes for the Hiawatha.
Oh, right. Oh, yes, yes.
Because he went on to do Hiawatha.
Indeed. He loved it, of course. He loved the scandal, Bodger. He loved it. He was like... And, of course, the stage door was crowded with reporters and cameras. But it all worked out that the man, Mary Whitehouse's solicitor, who'd come to see it, had sat in the back row. And apparently it all revolved around... He was so far back...
How much he could see.
What he could see anywhere. Yeah. And it all revolved about Peter Sproul's thumb or something.
That's right.
Anyway, it was it was done in Sheffield a few years ago. Was there a fuss? I never even heard a word about it.
No, I think Howard Brenton thought it was, you know, good to put it to bed and let the whole thing around it die just by putting on an ordinary production.
Right.
Because it wouldn't make a fuss anymore.
No. But it was. I think, to be honest, I think Peter Hall quite liked the fuss too, because it helped his tenure a lot. Because, I mean, there were two evening papers in London in those. There's the Standard and
the News.
The News. And both front pages the next day. Mm. And cartoons. Do you remember the cartoons in the paper? I'll be buggered if I go on there, and all those jokes, and articles everywhere, and fuss. It was extraordinary. And of course, there was a scene, I'll tell you the scene. We were rehearsing one day, and Greg, I think, was being raped by Peter Sproul. And I think they did it naked in the rehearsal room because they had to get used to that. And the rehearsal room one, I think, has a bit high roof, but there's a window along it,
right,
on
very,
one side.
Very, very high. Yeah.
And a minute, there was a man working on the roof. And he was looking in and watching this scene. He must have thought, bloody actors, what a bunch of ponces they are, you know?
He probably couldn't believe his eyes.
I know. My golly, yes.
Anyway, what a note to end on. We can't quite end there. So what was the favourite thing? You said that Olivier in Dance of Death was your favourite.
I did like that.
That he was in.
Yes.
And Front Page was...
I love doing Front Page here, and I love doing Leola. It's a really nice part, because people don't normally cast me as that kind of old bastard.
No,
you know?
You're a nasty old curmudgeon.
God, I've done so much. So here, and at the RSC, I think of plays.
I know. Well,
my brain's gone dead now.
People talk about how many you've done here, but you've done...
I've done a lot up there. I've done a lot. I'm very lucky, Heather. I work very hard. I work hard. I pretend I don't, but I work very hard. And I just love it. I just love the theatre. Yeah. And I want to go on forever.
Well,
I just want to go on forever.
I think I should let you go now so that you can go on at least tonight.
Nice, indeed. My God, yes. Our final three.
Yes, well, thank you very much.
Not at all. Thank you.